prove too inconvenient, they will break them. Though powerless countries obey the rules, powerful countries may not enforce the rules ex post if they are no longer in their own interest. And again, the rules even increase inequities even more.
You're listening to Joseph Stiglitz on democracy and the failure of neoliberal globalization. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So all of this is to try to say how difficult it is to get a just or even efficient system of rules in the current environment where we don't have a global government. In a way, policy is really going to be constrained to recognize that we are in this second or third best world. And what do we do? How do we improve things? And that's where, you know, most of the political activity is today. The third part of the talk, I want to talk about moving to a multipolar world with diffuse power, and particularly marked by strong polarization with this new Cold War. I should probably say the divisions are markedly different than in the old Cold War, or at least our perceptions are. It's not so much centering around ideology, though even then that was partially a facade. We always talked about the West being favor of democracy, but we overthrew democracies that we didn't like in the case of Chile and Pinochet. So we were never committed to democracy. There was an embarrassing summit of democracies that Biden convened where there were some countries that were obviously not democracy. What do you do when Biden cozies up to Modi, who is engaged in destroying a free press, attacking a very large minority within his country, and actually attacking free universities like JNU? And now Canada is saying that he actually killed a Canadian citizen on Canadian territory. It's a little bit important. Europe has made a very big deal of emphasizing we shouldn't talk about the fight against Russian invasion of Ukraine in terms of democracy. Because if Ukraine had not been a democracy, we would also have defended Ukraine. Maybe not so strongly, but we would have defended it because it was a violation of international law. I think that is an important point to keep in mind. But there is this new Cold War. It's opening up the potential for arch changes in the global economic architecture. In the presence of this real polarization, we're at a moment where we need real cooperation. Because if we don't address climate change together, we're all doomed. And there wasn't that sense during the Cold War, the old Cold War. So we're in this very peculiar situation where we are very interlinked in the way we were not before. Economically, we are interdependent because we share the same planet and we have to solve that problem. But clearly, there is this growing antipathy. The U.S. has proposed the notion of walled gardens, that there would be some areas where we would not allow free trade, but there'd be other areas where we would. And that's a peculiar and not persuasively persuasive idea. Let me talk a little bit about some of the reforms that are currently being discussed that highlight the dysfunction, I think, dysfunctionality of the current system and maybe hint to where we might go. Corporations operate across the world, and there's a problem. Where does their income get generated? And therefore, where can their income be taxed? Many of you may know that our most powerful and our most innovative corporations are also most skilled at tax evasion, avoidance. Example is Apple, where it claimed that all the profits that it earned in Europe were due to the economic activities of some 300-plus workers in Ireland who were working very hard to make billions and billions of dollars. You can imagine the productivity of each of those workers that they generated so many billions of dollars, each one. We were all so productive. And then a quirk, and it's not a quirk, but it was of the Irish tax law, has it that if you are a company that is effectively controlled outside your border, you don't pay taxes. So the subsidiary of Apple that was generating all these profits was not taxed in Ireland. So the total tax that they paid on their European profits was 0.2%. That's an example of tax avoidance, especially after 2008 and a concern about tax revenues. There was a global agenda to stop this. I had been involved in this issue since when I was on the Council of Economic Advisors because I felt the current system, which is called a transfer price system, where you make up prices to determine the value of what is produced in each country. So you have a shirt without sleeves, and you say, well, putting on the sleeves added this much value. So this system of called arm's length transfer price, the best example of in clothing, when you ship apparel to Panama and they sew in that made in Panama label, all the value of the shirt is due to that made in Panama label because everybody wants a made in Panama shirt. And the value of all the rest was nil. And it just so happens that Panama has a very low tax rate. That's an example of how the old system, the transfer price system, works. I had tried to change it without luck. It was one of my many failures when I was on the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. U.S. Treasury, reflecting the interest of corporations, did not want to change. After 2008 crisis and a lot of agitation, the OECD set up a process which was called BEPS, Base Erosion and Profit Shifting. And I think I've given you a flavor about how you do profit shifting so that you shift the profits to places that don't tax them. It's a major industry, and they have come up with a set of proposals that is now being discussed around the world. It has two pillars. The second pillar is a really important one, is a global minimum tax. And the U.S. has adopted not the form that they wanted, but a 15% minimum tax. That's too low. But the OECD initiative is 15% then, but with a lot of carve-out, so it's effectively like 12-13%. And that's even lower, so like half the rate of the corporate income tax in Latin America. It is an attempt to stop the race to the bottom, but it's clearly not a solution. The other part of it is what they call Pillar 1, and the question is it allocates taxing rights to different countries according to a formula, a particular approach. But the way it does it, not surprisingly, given that it was done, the way it was done, where it was done, and how it was done, allocated most of those taxing rights to the rich countries. So what was intended to be an initiative to increase the tax revenues of the developing countries and emerging markets, and all countries, has wound up being fairly ineffective. So that's an example of something that has not worked. And right now, there is a big move to shift it the negotiations from the OECD to the UN. The second thing I'll talk about very briefly is one aspect of the global financial system, and that is that related to the looming debt crisis in many developing countries and a few emerging markets. When you have zero interest rates for a long time, there is a tendency to borrow because the cost of borrowing isn't very high. And so many companies and many countries got over-indebted. And then with the interest rates going up very quickly from near zero to 5%, many countries are not able to service the debt. And many countries wound up even more indebted than they wanted to because of the pandemic, which they hadn't planned on, and even more so because the Ukraine war led to an increase in the price of oil and food. So there are a lot of countries that are highly indebted and won't be able to repay. Now, the fact that debt might not be repaid is something that happens all the time. I hope it doesn't happen to any of you, but it is part of life in capitalism. Okay, you get over indebted, and within our countries, we have ways of dealing with that, which is called bankruptcy laws. And bankruptcy laws decide who has first claim and who has second claim and how to take the limited resources and allow a fresh start, use the resources most efficiently, and have some fair way of dealing with the claimants. There is no international architecture for doing that. I help push a set of principles for doing that that was hoped to become a framework at the UN. And the UN General Assembly adopted the set of principles almost unanimously. I mean, it's really quite striking. Only six countries voted against. Unfortunately, they were the wrong countries. The United States, UK. So nothing happened. So here we are, 8 years later, a crisis on our hands, and no framework. And meanwhile, things have gotten even more complicated because the credit market has gotten more complex with many creditors. Banks have been replaced, or in addition to banks are the hedge funds. And in addition to the usual bilateral lenders, China, things are quite frankly a mess. And the hope that the IMF had, which I thought was never going to work and has not worked, is the putting in provisions in the contracts called things like collective action clauses would resolve the problem. And it improves things, but it's not enough. Making things even more problematic, the IMF is supposed to be acting countercyclically, stabilize the global economy. But the rules that it's adopted are de facto pro-cyclical. Just when countries need the money, it's jacked up the interest rate. So borrowing from the IMF has become very expensive and insufficient given the disproportionate growth of private liquidity. And then there are a provision that is not well known called surcharges are added on. If you are really in bad shape, they charge you even more, even though there have been almost no defaults. If there is a default, it will be because the IMF charged their surcharges. So they are creating their own problem. The result of this is that the total interest rate for some is now 8%, which is not really a low-interest loan. But the high interest rates are also a problem for countries turning to the multilateral development banks for financing green transition, because investments for the green transition that are profitable at low interest rates become unprofitable at the high interest rates. And it's very clear there's not enough capital within the multilateral development banks. So let me just conclude. There is a new balance of economic and political power emerging, which is markedly different from that of 1944 or even 1990. I think the advanced countries are loath to take on board the full implication. It's partly that there's been a really big shift in, I might say, ideology, the belief that markets would solve everything. It wasn't a full belief, as I said before, because we never acted on it, but it shaped policy, even if it was not adhered to. That belief is gone. I mean, there's still, you know, we still have the Republican Party, but they don't really even believe it themselves. They voted for the CHIPS Act, and they have supported all kinds of corporatism in the country. So the underlying market ideology isn't there. There isn't anything to replace it. So we are in a world basically where power is a defining part of what is going on. That has contributed to one of the factors contributing to the challenge to our democracy. If we look at it from a global point of view, democracy is in retreat. The fraction of people living in democracies has gone markedly down. But I believe that democracy is the only way forward that will lead to broad, inclusive societal well-being. My view is that the failure of globalization, neoliberal globalization, created, or at least was an important factor in creating what I describe as a fertile field for demagogues. That fertile field has now been tilled, and there are a host of demagogues, populists, and would-be authoritarians that have stepped in, not just in the United States, but in many countries around the world. When I look at globalization in the post-war era, it was shaped a lot by the United States, and its commitment to a borderless world, even if it was sort of not a selfless, it may have been, even if it was partly based on bad economics, and even if it was a move towards a world with fewer borders, where borders mattered less, how will the new globalization look? There are obvious questions posed by the fact that not only is the United States not taking leadership in globalization, one of the two parties in the United States is antithetical to any global, is really gone back to isolationist roots. That raises the question of which other countries, what other countries, will, are there other countries that can step into the breach if the United States can't do it? Can Europe do it? I find it very interesting. I began my talk saying it's really in the interest of smaller countries. And by small, I don't mean necessarily small in population, but in terms of economy, they have an interest in having a rule of law. I describe Brazil and Indonesia as two of the large democracies remaining. I'm not sure India is a democracy. It used to describe itself as the largest democracy in the world, but Modi has demoted it. Brazil and Indonesia, that I describe as the two largest functioning democracies in the emerging markets, can they step into the breach in shaping the agenda, norms, and institutions in the new global economic order, or will we continue to see dysfunctionality? What is so clear is, given the importance of climate change, we have to somehow find enough space for cooperation that we don't wind up totally polarized. But the reality will be that we will be somewhat polarized. The U.S. view has been basically, we can fight you in one arena and cooperate in another. It's not clear that that hypothesis is true, or if it is true, there may be limits on the way you fight in one arena that you need to impose if you're going to get cooperation in another. With that, let me stop.
I would like to ask you a question about the very nature of this emerging new world order, because you mentioned two features at the same time, and I would like to ask some clarifications, because in one sentence you said that it is emerging multipolar world order. At the same time, you also said we are witnessing an emerging new Cold War that was actually bipolar. So I was wondering about the number of the key players you think they are. And related to that, I'm really curious about your opinion about the role of Europe or the European Union in this new emerging world order. Thank you very much.
It's very clear is that the countries, you know, countries like Brazil and Indonesia, what used to be called the Third World, don't want to take sides. It's partly there is some antipathy to the West as a result of the pandemic and lots of other, you know, the colonial history. It's partly that they are very dependent on China. Yet many of them are democracies that feel more affinity to align with democratic countries. So they're being very explicit in a context where you see that is many of them have abstained in the votes of the UN on, in condemning Russian aggression. And you, you sort of wonder why this is, you know, there aren't many cases of black and white, and this seems to be one. And small countries have a very big interest, you would have thought, in making sure that the international rule of law, that one country doesn't invade another, because if a big country invaded them, they have no ability to resist. So it's very clear that they should be supporting this, and the question is why not? One of the reasons is that they are trying to stay outside of these two. You know, the conflict is between, basically, right now, U.S. and China. The size of these emerging markets is very different from what it was in 1944. The BRICS, which is not, which includes China and Russia, but the BRICS has a larger GDP than the advanced countries. So they're really large in GDP now. So they really do represent an other source of power if they were aggregated and if they worked together. And they are now trying to do that in a variety of ways. The BRICS extension was an example of that, to say we are not going to be dictated to by the advanced countries. So it is multipolar. It's a bipolar conflict. It's a Cold War, but multipolar sources. Now, Europe is the, where does it fit in this? Well, it's clear that in the current configuration, Europe is really aligned with U.S., basically through NATO, but Europe doesn't have its own independent defense force. Therefore, it knows that it's totally dependent on the United States, were that Russia to become more aggressive. In my sense is, you know, most Europeans would like to be aligned with the United States, but the United States is a very unreliable ally. If we elected Trump, would you want to be a partner? I'm not sure you would. So I've been telling Europe that it really is important for it to, you know, I'm against military spending, but I think in this world, it's what you have to do. And so I think there needs to be a European defense force. And I think Europe needs to be a more independent voice, a separate independent voice. And the reason I think that, because I think human rights and democracy are really important, I think, for the most part, with the exception of one or two countries, including yours, Europe is committed to democracy. And America, democracy is fragile. And so anybody believing in risk diversification says we ought to have really more independent sources of support for democracy and human rights.
You were just listening to Joseph Stiglitz on democracy and the failure of neoliberal globalization. He spoke in Florence, Italy in late September 2023. Joseph Stiglitz University professor at Columbia, is the recipient of the Nobel Prize in Economics. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Norman Finkelstein, Vandana Shiva, Phyllis Bennis, Medea Benjamin, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Joseph Stiglitz on Democracy and the Failure of Neoliberal Globalization, and the Noam Chomsky book, Notes on Resistance, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.
Do it.